Hee hee, ya booty.
So we are here today to talk My Brother's Blood Machine. However, we have some first-time guests on the podcast today. So we're going to go around the room and do some icebreakers. And the first question is, how did you get into Coheed and Cambria?
Okay, I'll start. So I was a freshman in high school, like 2004. And an upperclassman came up to me one day and said, hey, I've got this CD, and it seems like your brand of weird. And it was a burned copy of In Keeping Secrets. And I listened to it, told him I liked it. He let me borrow the original issue of Second Stage Turbine Blade, and I was instantly hooked. That was it. It was all over from there.
It's a really cool upperclassman.
Yeah.
Somewhat similar to Alex, it was In Keeping Secrets, and it was back in the day that Adult Swim, in addition to Bumps, would also have videos playing, and I believe it was Blood Red Summer, and I'm going to age myself a little bit. My oldest was 3, and it was all on, and I could hear it. I was like, what is that? It sounds really cool. And I go in there, and he's just like running around like a madman, and I didn't catch the name of the band. And he kept saying, you know, I want the Good Eye Sniper CD. I'm like, okay, like, what are we talking about? And so we go to the store a couple days later, and we're looking through CDs, and he sees it, and that's it. And he's like, that's it. I'm like, okay. We put it on in the car, and that was it. So ever since then, been my favorite band since 2004. So yeah, supposed to bring him to one of the shows on this tour. So that will be fun. It'll be my 4th or 5th time seeing them, I think. So yeah.
Okay, so I have a very weird story that I think, Devin, I think you've heard it before, but basically I first heard them in 2005 when Welcome Home came out, like pretty much everybody. And I listened to the rest of the singles that had also come out for Good Apollo. And I liked all of that. I was like, wow, all cool. So I was like, I guess I got to listen to the whole album. Like, if I like all the singles, then I must like the album. And I didn't. I didn't like it. So I didn't bother looking into the rest of the discography. I was just like, yeah, it's okay. I'll just stick with the singles. No big deal. So I shelved it. And then came 2020 when we're all stuck at home. I'm revisiting my music collection because I'm the kind of weirdo that likes to physically own all my media and stuff. I'll like purchase downloads. So like all of the music I own is mine. I don't stream anything. And I wanted to make sure that all of the like album art was correct and the years and the track numbers because I'm crazy. And I had nothing better to do. It was 2020. We're all stuck at home. And I start going through it and I get to Coheed and I am looking for updated album art and I realize that there's 3 album arts and I'm like, why are there 3? I'm not entirely unused to that. Like I come from like anime where they'll have like tons of different album art for a variety of artists. So I'm not like that shocked by it, but I'm like, okay, I need to know like what to put here. So I do some research, and one of the album art is Christopher Shai's art from the graphic novel. And that's when I find out about the story. And I went down a rabbit hole, a very big rabbit hole, where I learned all about the story, or at least as much as I could from just, you know, reading about it online. And then I decided to listen to the whole discography in, like, chronological order. So I started with Afterman and then worked my way down until Baxis 1, because at the time Baxis 1 had just was the recent one. So I was like in love. I was like, oh no, that's it. This sold me multimedia like fandom. I'm here for it. Let's go. So now here I am. So yeah, that's my story.
Late bloomers are okay. That's awesome.
Yep.
What's everyone's favorite album and favorite song? And it does not have to be from that. I know.
Hitting us with the hard questions. God.
I'm gonna cheat a little bit here, because it is a dual album. The Afterman is probably my favorite Coheed record. Those albums have a lot of personal meaning to me. My favorite Coheed song is almost impossible to tell you. I think lately I've been revisiting Good Apollo, and so I'd probably say The Telling Truth is probably like my current favorite track.
Very solid picks.
Man, really not prepared for this question. I would really have to say for me, it's always a toss up, but I'm going to go with In Keeping Secrets. That's my hands down favorite album. It would be that or Good Apollo, but it's hard to pick when they're all so good. Favorite song, I feel, does the Camp Revolorium Suite count as a favorite song? Can I have all of them together? If that was an option, I would pick that. It would have to be, I don't know, I'm going to go with what's been my favorite lately, and that's Ladders of Supremacy, so I'll just stick with that.
That was kind of out of left field, and you're like, oh, Camp.
No, it's been on heavy rotation. It's just so good. But yeah, that was the one that just kind of just kept popping up in my head, because that's on my drive to work playlist, so.
So I'm literally looking through the albums, like, right now, like, trying to decide. Oh man. Yeah, I think insofar as like entire album, like for like a total cohesiveness, I think it also would have to be Afterman, like the both of them together for me too. It's just such a like, everything is great. The diversity is great. The story is pretty, I mean, it's just, everything is spot on. Everything is great. So I think as like a whole cohesive album, I'd probably have to pick like The Afterman's. But favorite song, it's impossible. It's impossible. Every album has a banger. Like every album is like, oh, that's sure. The one I can't not listen to. I've told people this before, but I'll shuffle my music occasionally and a single Coheed track will come on and I'll go, oh, this is like my favorite episode of my favorite show, because it's like literally like when you're watching TV and a random episode of something comes on and you're like, oh, I know this episode. I can't not watch it. Like I have to watch it. So I have to listen to it. I usually just say Welcome Home because that's the one that everybody knows and it's easy to go to. I would say that my favorite single off of Good Apollo, though, from those initial tracks is probably 10 Speed. But I also, man, Ladders is just such a banger. Like,
it really is.
I think for me right now, Ladders is definitely the one. I played it for one of my friends one time when we were traveling, and he was like, damn, this song is great. And I'm like, I know, right? It's so good. So, yeah.
I definitely hope they bring Ladders out for this upcoming No World for Tomorrow Never Ender.
I want nothing more than to hear a whole crowd do a falsetto stay like that. That would be the best.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, they'd have to go into Rise and then the title track and then send us out with another encore of every song in their discography.
It's only correct that they would do that. You can't just cut off at Ladders. It has to have that drop off, you know? It's such a good transition. Ugh.
Well, speaking of transition, we are going to move along with what we are here to talk about today, and that is My Brother's Blood Machine. So for issue one, we do have some merch. We talked about it during our live stream, which I made a boo-boo, and we no longer have the audio to that, so we'll cover a couple things. Again, if you were there, apologize, this may be old news to you, but we have the San Diego Comic-Con and New York Comic-Con preview books. We have the standard retail cover with art by Andrew Ritchie. The Jetpack Comics cover by Vero Stewart. I believe all the variants will be done by Vero Stewart for Jetpack Comics. The Revolver Magazine issue one cover by Christian Dabari. And then that wonderful Evil Inc. cover. Those were limited to bundles of 1,000 and include tarot cards.
It's the one that I have, yeah.
And then lastly, if you are a collector and like really want to torture yourself, you can get the US and UK previews books. They feature little advertisements for My Brother's Blood Machine. The first one starts with October 22's issue 409.
The Evil Ink cover was by Nat Jones.
Thank you. I just totally skipped over that. Speaking of personnel, we are moving on with the lineup, I guess, for this comic. So it is created by Claudio, and it's written by both Claudio and Steve Niles. It's illustrated by Andrew Ritchie, colored by Adam Metcalf, lettering done by Ed Dukeshire. Logo was done by Kyle Crawford, with design by Monica Richards. And of course, we do have Chandra doing some editing. So without further ado, let's jump into the discussion. Let's talk about it.
Oh, man, where to start? This issue, so like I said, I was a fan in 04. I was immediately all about all things Coheed. I bought My Brother's Blood Machine in 06 the minute it came out. Saw the tarot cards, listened to them, had so many things running through my mind of what this could be about. And right off the bat, as soon as I opened up issue one, I was so wrong about a lot of things. But it's they're all welcome wrongs. I love the direction, the time period that it's set in, everything about it.
Wholeheartedly agree. Like, I definitely also had different visions for what was going on exactly, but wow, this is great. No complaints from me at all. And Andrew Ritchie's art is just so creepy that it really adds to the atmosphere too. So it's just 10 out of 10.
Yeah, no, it's so super off kilter and it's just dirty. And I don't know if it was Alex, somebody compared it to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, if it was a comic book. I also, the whole tarot card thing, especially with this first issue, the card that comes with it is the Chariot. And I don't know how much you guys know about that, but it's very apt for this issue. It's kind of setting a stage for that. And I think that's really interesting and really neat.
And on the cover of the standard retail is Lermit. I pronounced that correctly. The Hermit. That's how I'm internalizing this. Someone carrying a like a light box, I guess, or candle. Can you fill me in on this tarot card? I'm a little low.
Yeah. So the Chariot one in its upright placement, that's more aligned with control, willpower, action, determination. So what's interesting about the art on the tarot card? So you have the charioteer, if you will. He has a wand. There's no reins. So he's really controlling that, ironically, the strength of his will and mind. So, you know, my brain wants to run over to Vaxis. I'm sure that's just my brain just wanting to do what it does. Usually there's crescent moons on the warrior. And I mean, this is a little more bare bones on the tarot card, but that usually represents coming into being. The laurel and star crown, that's kind of a victory, success, spiritual evolution. In a normal, not this version of the tarot card, it has a black and white sphinx that are going kind of in alternate directions. And the charioteer, of course, is, you know, supposed to draw them together. And this one, they're not necessarily sphinxes, but they're horses and they are both dead. And they're both facing the same direction. So do with that what you will. And there's always a river that the charioteer and the chariot are in, which means to be in the flow with the rhythm of life while still charging ahead, you know, with your goals and intentions. So he's guiding it with his will and his mind. And then, you know, your sphinxes aren't going in two different directions. They're both dead. They're just laying on the ground. That's it. I feel like that's kind of all apt with this issue for sure.
Yeah, you know, you turn to that first page and before you even get to the actual content where you learn the setting and the location, you have that picture of Cecilia, that black and white picture, you know, all the credits are, and that just is like, oh, man.
But yes.
If the cover it didn't freak you out enough, when you flip open to right. That page, it's like, snap. All right. This is the kind of story we're getting into. And there was the music video that came out, and that kind of, it to me, put the theme and the setting in my head. And now it's totally different from almost like Lancaster, Pennsylvania vibe. Out in the wilderness doing these things. Now we're in the late 60s in Margaretville. It's like this very hunky-dory town, so it seems.
Why we ever thought that the music video would line up to what actually happened, I don't know.
I was about to say that. I've never seen that music video, but even if I had, I'd been like, well, I mean, this really has nothing to do with this.
Sure, yep, we're in the same vein right now.
I wanted to take it so at face value back in, 2006, 2007. And so, when I was a teenager listening to this record, I was like, this is like some Puritan times, early 1800s. There's wild stuff going down and a bunch of religious fanatics. That's what this is about. That was way off.
The story takes place March 15th, 1968, a day before the Jubilee. That's kind of how we start. And everything goes downhill from there. We learn that Victor Fontana is missing. Gunner Recall is the prime suspect. Cecilia and her stepfather, makes a very big point to call him stepfather, have a very creepy interaction. And there's just this uneasy tone throughout the entire thing.
Moses Early is a worker at Arthur's business, which is very interesting too. I don't know if anybody else had envisioned this to all. Well, I think we all kind of talked about it, how we all just thought it was like an Amish town set in the 1800s, right? So when you think of Amish people, you don't usually think of different colors. You usually just think, oh, everybody's white. But it's interesting that they chose to make Moses Early black, which I think is a cool choice. And I'm interested to see where they take that too, especially given that this is the 60s.
Yeah, I think like the time period that the story is established in, it makes it really interesting. And, I couldn't help myself but to think back and listen to My Brother's Blood Machine and, the track, The Fight of Moses Early and Sir Arthur MacLeod. This is not what I pictured, but just the way that it's playing out, I thought was a really cool, like, is this the fight that song's about? Like, is this where it all begins,
A worker is accused by a patron of stealing something from a car, and the boss isn't sticking up for him in that situation. Like, again, we're in the late 60s, the context of the racial undertones here and everything.
Exactly.
So he quits. He straight up quits.
I'm really excited to see what, if we get more, and what his role in the remaining issues is.
And Cecilia is shown to be a caring character, right? She goes up and checks on him, and it's like, definitely the final girl vibes are so strong.
Her face when he's driving off in that one panel, it broke my heart a little bit. Because like that was her, it was like he was kind of like her ray of light. It gave her happiness, I guess, obviously, to see him when she was having to bring the creepy stepdad his lunch. That, I'm sorry, he was not accidentally leaving that. I feel like he did that on purpose because he's such a creep. Just the excuse to get her to go up there or whatever.
A couple panels down from that, when she has the interaction with Arthur, and the line harkens back to the lyrics, what a darling daughter you are. The art in the panel where she's pulling her hand away and saying, I need to go to school. That is, it's the one thing that stuck out in this series so far, is the facial expressions are so striking. You can feel the emotion, and it plays through so smoothly.
Absolutely.
Also, Moses is the only character that goes against these accusations of Gunner Recall. He tells Cecilia that it might not be what everyone says it to be, and then we see Gunner Recall. And I don't know if this was actually Cecilia seeing him or like just a vision that she has, but I think he's actually there, just hiding out, trying to find a place to go. But he says, I didn't do it.
Yeah, that was to have those two things happen, one page after the other in here. That really stood out a lot. And it does say a lot about, taking things at face value versus giving them some critical thinking.
Yeah.
It also feels a little bit like Moses might have a better understanding of some of the other things that we will come to learn about. And so it kind of feels like he's like, oh, Cecilia, like, don't judge a book by its cover. Like, you never know, like, if there's more to it. And it's like, yeah, you're so right, Moses. So I feel like it's a little bit of foreshadowing there, too.
I know, for sure, because that's a very ominous line, and the way he said it and everything. The writing in this so far is just, it's great.
when you read Second Stage and you're just starting out with all the lore, it's a little all over the place. There's quite a bit to get through. But once Innkeeping Secrets hits and Claudio's working with Peter David, and then we move forward and he's working with Chandra, and Claudio writing with another person, it gets very focused and some great stories come out. And I think that's Steve Niles was such a great choice for the story, because you have the warning, you have the I didn't do it, and then you have the grand reveal the following page where someone slips and falls into all these bodies. And it's like that layers on top of each other. And it's like, oh man, it's such a good payoff because it is such a limited series. They have to have these like crazy moments.
No, I agree. When I saw that Steve Niles was writing it with him, I was like, I'm in, I'm done. It's over with, because he's written two of my favorite series. So, well, I guess now three.
Then we get introduced to, I kind of believe, a new character, Glenn. Upon listening to the original record, I don't recall anything involving this character, and Cecilia's love interest, I guess.
Yes, it seems Johnny has been replaced by Glenn, and I don't know how I feel about it, actually. I was really looking forward to Johnny early, man. I was like, especially in the preview, like, because the preview just had the first couple of pages for the first issue, and I was like, oh, damn, I am so excited for, like, Johnny to be black, and Cecilia is this, like, hippie chick, and she's coming from this broken home, and I'm like, they're going to be like Romeo and Juliet, kind of. I was really excited to see that dynamic, and obviously, they changed it for a reason, right? So I'm still excited, but I can't help but be a little disappointed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was so set on re-listening to that album, reading all the lyrics, and remembering like the little bits that, you know, were kind of briefly whispered about. And yeah, same thing. I was like, oh, Johnny Early's going to show up. And I was like, who the hell is Glenn? Like, where did Glenn come from?
Such a good name for the character of the time, though. Glenn, man. Yeah, what's up, Glenn?
What's going on, Glenn?
But he seems like a cool dude. You know, he gives Cecilia a locket and is listening to her woes and willing to run away with her, all that fun jazz. And then the story turns again into another dark twist.
So the locket, just briefly, I really wonder, because it's such a faded image and it's really hiding a lot, but I wonder so much of what is the importance of the people in the locket. Is there an importance of the two people in the locket? That I thought was just a really cool panel.
So I have the digital version of the comics, because I'm going to wait until they all get collected before I buy like a single volume. But in the digital version, you can click on the individual panels to kind of bring them up and make them bigger. And in my opinion, they look like the bleems. Because the one on the left has like a long face, and then the one on the right has like a short, stout face, and he's even got like a rip through the picture, which kind of looks like his like. It's that. I'm like, ooh, that kind of looks like the boys, you know? So maybe
that's gonna be a problem if that's who it is. That's gonna be a problem at some point in the next few issues. So.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting.
Did anybody else cry on the inside just a little bit when Wayne Andrews only got like five panels?
Yes. Absolutely. I was,
like, as soon as I saw the beekeeping and stuff, I was like, oh, it's Wayne Andrews, the old beekeeper. I can't wait. And then I flipped the page and I was like, no.
Well, if you count the page after, he technically got six, or he got, you know, he got five and a full page, if you will.
His body got six. He got five.
This was like slash movie. Like,
it's beautiful in the worst way. It is just, it's so great. And I kind of forgot about it. It was a few pages before we see Glenn and everything, when, you know, it's like the one really pretty panel out of everything. It's the bees and the flowers. And then the next panel, it's the bloody boots squishing on it, which is also kind of a duality of, you know, man / the universe, whatever, if you will. And then it goes from that more bloody boots, this whole mess at the bottom. So I think I flipped back and forth between, you know, poor old beekeeper being split in two, to going back to that, like, that escalated super fast, and now I'm sad. That was the one picturesque, oh, look how sweet this one little panel is. And then it was gone.
Yeah. One thing I really love, and we'll see it more, is all the pages that have a panel of Long Arm or Butchie killing someone. There's this blood splatter just outside the panel. I thought that was such a cool tie-in for the comic because it kind of breaks it out of the confines of the panel.
It does.
You know?
It does. I do really like that.
Seeing those like gory pages definitely reminded me of the statement that Andrew Ritchie gave when he was tasked with drawing the series. He was like, "You're not going to make me make this pretty, are you?" And Sanchez was like, "No, man, like, go wild." And he's like, "Okay." Because I see them and I'm like, "Oh, yeah, this is definitely not pretty."
No, it's absolutely the right person. I don't think it could be anybody else. Glenn's asking her, "You really hate that dude, huh?" And just her face, her poor face through this whole thing. It's just the most defeated. I just feel so awful for her.
That bottom left-hand panel right after Wayne Andrews meets his demise, when Cecilia's just looking down at the dinner table, oh, that facial expression might be the entire book. The colors are fantastic, too, and I think that they're done on purpose to be not necessarily dull, but almost have, like, this sepia tone over it. So when they get bloody, it just makes the blood stand out so much more.
Everything's masked behind mustard yellow.
Right. And I mean, that could also be the nicotine stains because, you know, they're smoking at the table. There's all these ashtrays, too. So why not have that be dingy and gross? Also, I have to say that transition from him being split in two to the outside, you know, past the meat. I was like, are we serious here? Like, what? Like, that's just a 1-2 punch right there. Like, I don't know that I was ready for that, but OK.
It's like, now here's a wholesome family dinner. Like, right. Okay, great. Thanks. Whiplash.
I know. It's like, all right, this is great. But no, I just feel so bad for her. And then just everything about that quote unquote family dinner is like, this is the most dysfunctional, terrible, skewed version of a family dinner possible.
I will say, I think there's a massive character development for Cecilia on the page after she's, you know, staring down at the table and very upset.
Yes.
The panel where she says, "I really don't give a damn." That to me doesn't look like anger as much as it reads as like determination. To me, that's a huge like growing moment for Cecilia. And I love that.
Now she's finally starting to stand up for herself some. And obviously, as we know, it doesn't go over well. And I mean, she had even tried to tell her mom, "Hey, I'm not going to the Jubilee thing. And the guy's a creep. I don't want to be there."
We kind of close out the book with unspeakable. It's the Bleem brothers themselves, the blood machine. It's all here. After all this time, after all this waiting, we get to see it with our own two eyes. And then there's some blue energy coming out of the blood machine. And that drives me crazy. That honestly keeps me up.
Same here. The blues and the grays and the blood and the rust, like all the inking on these is just, it's so good.
It's perfect.
It really is. And I'm not super versed in Prizefighter Inferno lore. I will be the first to admit that. However, there's always this overarching thing of some type of divine energy. And I mean, this is 1968 in a small town. Cecilia and Glenn had mentioned something about stories they heard as kids. And there's a few things that the Bleem brothers do say that very much implies that they are religious zealots. You know, like, "Your work is divine, brother. And no doubt he," with emphasis, "will see and we shall be rewarded." And, you know, you can almost feel his gratitude. I'm like, okay, so we're going into like religious extremism. What else do they have going on for them, right?
The one thing that excited me about these final pages is the one thing that I was right about in 2006 was that the blood machine was a physical machine of some sort. I remember my first listens through and trying to, you know, picture it in my mind. I had thought it was like this 1800s thing. So I imagined like a wood crank, like hand machine. But to see that there's a physical machine, that I got really excited about.
Yeah.
And Devin, like you had mentioned, the Blue Energy, it lost my mind because it hasn't really been shown in the series, but the whole, you know, premise of Prize Fighter was that it was supposed to be a story told by Jesse, by Inferno, and that he had been, you know, like sent back in time or something. And so when I saw this back panel with the Blue Energy coming out of the machine, I immediately thought back to Year of the Black Rainbow, when Cody and Cambria and Jesse see what Wilhelm Ryan is up to. And, you know, when Claudio gets sent off to, you know, Shiloh's 10, and he's seeing the stars be pushing this machine, and there's Blue Energy coming out, and you're like, oh, is this a precursor for like what's to come? Yeah. Like, it's the energy that binds.
It's the overarching theme, which, I mean, if it's not that, I don't know how I'm going to feel about it. But got that last panel with their faces. It's just, ugh.
Oh, yeah. I love that Butchie has like three eyes, it almost looks like.
Yes, yeah. it does look like he does.
Like, it looks like he has two noses and three eyes, like he was almost a twin, but like absorbed it, you know?
Yeah, it's and just, his personality so is creepy. Definitely like absorbs twin. Like, that's his personality for sure.
Yeah, it's so creepy. I love it.
No, there's not a peaceful, like, there's the two panels where we're like, oh, this looks okay. And then everything else is just a shit show. It's a nightmare. And it's phenomenal. I'm probably going to break my streak and go and read the other ones that I have tonight, honestly.
It doesn't get better.
Oh, I know, but I like that. No,
I love it. It's so bleak.
This isn't Prize Fighter related, but there was this, I think, 5 or 6 issue run. I don't know when it came out, but I happened across it at a comic shop probably 20 years ago, but it was called The Milkman Murders. And it's kind of set in the same era, and it's just, it sounds as messed up as it is.
It also reminds me of the Feathers music video.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, a little bit. It is something. But so it's not really necessarily the coloring or the art style. It's maybe just the general overtone, just everything's supposed to look nice, right? Because it's a nice little town, and it's obviously very, very far from that.
The duality of you know, you start out with Miss Caldwell, you know, saying to Cecilia, like, good morning, you know, welcome her. And then the end of this issue is, you know, the Bleem brothers putting a body into a coffin to send it through the machine, which is like, finally, we get to see what the coffin means, that symbol that's on the records, on the die-cast cut records. It's like,
yes,
okay, the coffin is a part of the machine. And seeing all these like little things finally come together and start to happen is just so incredible.
That, you know, while they're both very disfigured, that one of his shoes has the really big heel on it, because he's so, like, I don't know how I missed it, but I just was like, oh, look at that.
Okay. That stood out to me big. Like, you know, like, I remember, you know, hearing the names and reading, you know, little snippets when the record first came out, and hearing the names Longarm and Butchie, and not really understanding, like, it was so literal. But seeing them, you know, kind of on the page, it really shows just how messed up they are, and the way that their personalities and their beliefs kind of feed into that outward physical appearance that they have. That, I think, is real crazy.
I can't get over the coloring on those panels, and now my brain's going to be going crazy forever about this. The Blue Energy that we have going on. Thank you, Devin, for making me hyper focus on that even more. I appreciate that.
It's just interesting to see all the characters' motives. When we're talking about Glenn, everything is so wholesome as it can be, and his problem is with Mr. Clem, their coach and their gym teacher, and like, Cecilia's dealing with something so much darker and sinister, and like, he's kind of a beacon for her. And then underneath all of that, you have the Bleem brothers, and it's like, there's so many different little stories that are like weaving their way into each other. And even if it doesn't tie back into the Coheed of it all, it does stand alone as its own tale. It's very interesting. It feels very Wes Craven, Nightmare on Elm Street vibes to it.
Yeah.
It's like reading a horror movie. I love it.
I do, since you talked about Glenn and, you know, his biggest issues kind of seem like to be the gym coach or whatever, I did find it to be very interesting, the interaction with Cecilia, where, you know, she's talking about how much she hates her stepfather, and she cuts off her words saying, you know, like, well, you know, if I'd had my way, he'd be dead, then he would stop. And so it kind of felt to me like she's not telling him. She's not wanting to hurt him or worry him or make anybody kind of deal with what she sees as her problems. So I thought that was, again, very interesting for her character.
Right. Yeah. She's just kind of, she's just probably saying, yeah, he's a jerk. He, you know, has a temper, you know, any of the 1968 ways of saying, you know, he's abusive.
The interaction with Moses where he's telling her that, you know, like things may not always be what they seem. That was another thing that I felt the theme of the record was when it came out, was that things aren't always great. Because, you know, just from the lyrics and everything, it sounded like Arthur McLeod was someone kind of prominence in the community. And that, yeah, absolutely. There was some sinister stuff going on in the background that is pretty well spelled out in the lyrics. And so, yeah, it always kind of took that tone of don't trust everything you see. Like there's a worse monster out there.
Right. This was what the first, in the comic and in the 60s in general, that was the first experience with quote unquote satanic panic, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they threw that out there, what, in the first three pages, I think. That's how you pin it on the poor loner kid who doesn't have any friends, right? Well, he's a weirdo. So, you know, clearly he's this.
When you were starting to get into Kobe, to delve into the story of My Brother's Blood Machine, and has that changed? Obviously, now that we have the issues, were there any like big changes that you were kind of thrown off by in this first issue?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, you know, again, just in case people don't know, I'm the one that wrote the Gonz Grad Wiki. And basically, in 2005, when Sanchez started talking about like the story of what that album was supposed to be, because again, you know, back then we only had very little, he kind of mentioned that it was supposed to be a prequel. He did talk about how Jesse was supposed to like come back in this universe, resurrected or revived or something into the present day-ish, which I don't know why in 2005 present day-ish didn't clue me in that it wasn't going to be in the 1800s, but okay, yeah, that makes sense. And then he had said Jesse wanted to tell people about the Amory Wars, but in order to do it, he had to tell the story of the Blood Machine. And then we talked, you know, we get like this whole like really quick breakdown where it's, you know, the early family, the McLeod family, and the Bleem family, and that there's going to be a whole bunch of side stories and stuff like that. And yeah, Texas Chainsaw Massacre was mentioned at this time, where Claudio was like, it's kind of like that, you know, like it's a weirdo family meets, you know, the Amory Wars. And that the two boys, the Bleem brothers, are called by God, according to their mother, to become the new death of the world, and that they need to, you know, kill for God, basically. And they decide that the best way to do that is to make a machine that will literally wring the soul from a person's body to give it, you know, to God. One of the things that I did see recently is that Claudio did confirm that Inferno is not the narrator of this story, which I think is pretty obvious from this issue, because if he was, it'd be like second stage where we're seeing his like, you know, oh, my brother did this and my brother did that, you know, like we'd see him narrating, but right. He's not. And I personally kind of think that that would be really convoluted. So I'm actually really glad that that's a change that happened. I would love to see the characters come in at some point, and I'm not ruling it out yet, but I do think that that was a good choice. The Amish thing, I think, is definitely the music video for Who Watches the Watchmen that really got everybody clued in on, if this isn't the 1800s, then this town is an Amish town, right? Something has to be going on here, that these people live a backwards life, right? Which is not the case. Definitely not the case. These people are not Amish. As far as we've seen, there are no Amish people in this town. I also kind of got the impression a little bit that it was 1800s-ish, because the fight of Moses Early and Arthur McLeod is Sir Arthur McLeod. And usually that has to do with knighthood. So I was thinking, oh, maybe he's like, you know, some like fancy schmancy dude that like came over, you know, emigrated to the United States, and, you know, come up with all sorts of fun things about how that works out. But I guess in this context, really, it's that he's like top dog of the town, right? So like the sir is almost a little bit like of a jab, like it's kind of like a misnomer, like, oh, you think you're like, you know, the knight of this town, you know, but he's obviously not. He's like super corrupt and stuff. So yeah, him being a car salesman was particularly interesting. I was like, I guess that's a valid business in the, you know, in the 60s. So, okay.
Yeah.
If I see a single burly mustachioed character somewhere in this series, I'm going to consider it confirmed. Jesse was there. That's it. End of story.
Yeah. I had my own theory about exactly what was happening in the story based on the CD. And I understand, because there is a little disclaimer on the credit page of the comic, that it is more or less based on, that they're not necessarily going like 100% track by track and whatnot. But I can definitely see the inspiration here and there. And so that's pretty cool. For instance, in interviews, we got the name Johnny, Moses's son, Johnny. So, okay, that didn't happen. You know, it's been like, what, over almost 20 years. Things change, you know, so that's fine. But I do hope that maybe Moses does have a son, and maybe after things happen, we'll still see him, you know. So not all hope is lost, but it is interesting to kind of see how, you know, your thought processes change based on like what you can kind of glimpse of things. Did I answer your question? I feel like I just rambled.
No, that was awesome. I do think that you may have broken some hearts and minds when you said this was 20 years ago. It's like
almost 20 years ago. Let's be real.
But on that, when the record came out in 2006, I believe it was from an interview, Claudio did say that he had been writing and recording this stuff for the previous 7 years. And so with that context in mind, when you go back and you listen to My Brother's Blood Machine, and then you listen to like old Shibuti stuff and Second Stage stuff, you're like, oh, I hear it. Like, I hear the differences in the way he writes, the way he sings or records. And
So
20 years is, you know, it's pretty on the nose for when this stuff was going down in his mind, at least.
Yeah, it started as like a campfire story that he'd tell. And evolving over time, the idea was that Inferno was going to ride in on a motorcycle and stop by a bar and start telling the story. And like, I definitely appreciate the approach that we have now. And again, like, even if it doesn't tie in at all, it still kind of has this like multiverse kind of vibe. You know, there is still the idea of bodies going through a machine to release the soul. So it doesn't, you know, maybe it's just showing that no matter what universe in the Amory realm that we're in, there's always going to be these kinds of characters that are extracting souls for powers for some unseen, unknown greater cause.
Yeah, that part is something I'm super excited to see kind of play out. And I mean, throughout all of the Amory Wars, there's always been this question of God and what his intentions are and what he wants. And so I think the idea that you know, the Bleem's mother is giving them her interpretation of, well, this is what God wants, is pretty par for the course for Amory Wars stuff, and you know, the extremes that people will go to.
Definitely agree. There's always some kind of good versus evil, once again, duality, you know, all that stuff. I have to say, after hearing Jan talk about, you know, all the background lore, because you guys are more versed on the Prize Fighter Inferno, I'm kind of glad that I had really no idea what I was walking into. I really am. You know, no preconceived notion, because I hadn't seen the video or anything. So to me, because a friend of mine who, fortunately for him, he's super into Coheed now. And I was like, hey, dude, you know, you can borrow these books and everything. And he was super pumped about it. And he was like, you know, I need more of it. I'm like, okay, well, you're caught up now. Like, there's nothing else to catch up on. But he didn't have any preconceived notion of anything, really, other than, you know, the briefest rundown that I gave him. If I could go back and, you know, re-experience it for the first time, I would. So I don't know. I think I'm just excited that I get to experience this for the first time with no real idea of what I'm in for.
I'm the friend who the briefest rundown of the Amory Wars usually starts with me asking if they have about 9 free hours. Just this evening.
I had to break it down over like a 30-minute conversation because he was, you know, just like, okay, I saw that there's this, this, and this. It's like, okay, I'm mailing these to you. He doesn't live here. It's like, I'm mailing these to you. He's like, okay, but give me a breakdown in the meantime. And I'm like, ah, how much time do you have? And he's like, about half an hour. I'm on my break. It's like, oh, okay, look, like, let's do it. we ran through it. And he was like, you didn't tell me enough. It's like, you only gave me 30 minutes. So, I mean, what else was I supposed to do at that point?
May I recommend just sending them the Gonskrod wiki?
Oh, no, I absolutely will. That's what I'm saying.
My own horn.
No, I
shameless
didn't know it
self-plug. I love it.
Well,
Jenny,
I mean,
it's
that
okay.
It's a two-pound horn, but like I have that for that reason because A, the story is hella complicated and really confusing.
It
and
is.
Sometimes you just need to like have a nice breakdown, but also because, yeah, it's, you know, short little summaries. You can kind of read into it. You can see pretty pictures. It's great. I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm excited that I know that it exists now because, you know, so thank you.
Absolutely.
I will definitely.
So glad.
Jan comes through again and helps us segue into the next part of our podcast here, our plugs. This is where you guys can share where to find you, any messages for the COTF who may have listened to this episode. I will personally plug the Gonskrod Wiki. As much as we do our own research here on ATC, sometimes just go into the Gonskrod Wiki. I know Jan's got it. It's cool. It's easy to navigate. And
I cite my sources. It's good.
Okay. I'm not huge on social media stuff. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram at @scudkid. And anyone who wants to, you know, say hello. And if I'm not being super anxious, I will see you guys May 20th at the Tabernacle. And I will see everyone who is on SS Neverender 2 in October. And I can't wait to be there with you guys.
I am at Color Me Creepy on Twitter, Instagram. Holly on Facebook with an E, and I have not decided what two shows I'm going to. I was going to go to the one in New Orleans because that's an hour from me, and I will be out of the country that week. So then I found out the Tabernacle sold out, so it's probably going to be a Texas show and the Birmingham, Alabama show for me. But I'm just glad we finally got the Never Ender because, as we all know, it got canceled, and I had Mage for that, and I was sad. I'm still sad about it, but you know, I've met him once before. So, and Devin's probably laughing. You've met them once, you mere mortal. Mage would have been cool. I'm not that worried about it this time around. But as long as I get to go see this damn Never Ender at least once, preferably twice, but at least once, it'll happen. Just got to figure out what state.
I mean, yeah, the Gonskrod is like my claim to fame. So I'll just, you know, check that out. Woohoo! I am on social media. I do like other stuff like cosplay and like other nerdy stuff. I do panels at conventions and stuff like that. My handle is really long and obnoxious, but it's Kurahane Shizumi. Good luck with that. If you Google it, you'll find me everywhere. And that's basically it. So yeah, I'm simple.
Well, thank you guys so much for joining the ATC for MBM, because all we do is use little...
Well, you have to use acronyms.
Yeah, it's just, that's NWFT, you know, it's right. Just, you just say no world, but it's fine.
Either
no, yeah,
or, it
thank
works.
You for, thank you for having me. This was really cool. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, same. This is a good time for sure. Thank you.
I'm always down to talk stories, so, you know, hit me
sure.
up anytime.
Me too.
We've got plenty.
Same here.
And hopefully we'll actually have No World content. Hopefully by the end of the year. The first issue is being colored. I think they're on like the third page or something like that.
Shut your mouth.
So excited.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Just a preview. No,
we can only handle so many things at a time right now.
This has been another episode of the All Things Coheed podcast. I'm Devin.
I'm Alex.
I'm Holly.
And I'm a gal named Jan.
I love that.
Thanks for joining us.
Devin, I think you're muted.
Thank you. I was
absolutely. I saw his face light up and his mouth open, and then nothing happened. And I was like, oh no.
Good looking out.
That's why we love you, Jen. You got it. You got it covered.
Yo. Where would the wiki be without this info?
Where would the wiki be?